Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, I am joined by entrepreneur and founder of sports recovery company, MyoMaster. Welcome to the Power Hour, Lottie White.
Thank you. Like you said, I feel like it's been a long time coming.
A long time coming. I do not know what has taken us so long, but I guess we're just really out here, Lottie. We're really out here being busy, doing all
living.
The things.
Living,
exactly. And Lottie, you have been very busy recently. We've all seen clips on social media of you on Dragon's Den. Congratulations, firstly, on, and from what I've seen, an incredible pitch, a masterclass, an absolute masterclass in how to pitch your business, showcase your domain expertise, and stay cool under pressure.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's been billed. That's the world's words rather than mine. But I feel like it went very well. We got a very kind edit, that's for sure.
Oh, well, yeah, that's my words, because I saw it and went, yes, this is what
you.
We do. So let's go back before we get into all of that. Let's go back for anyone who doesn't know about your entrepreneurial journey or about MyoMaster. You started your company whilst on maternity leave, so after having your first child. So let's talk about that, because some people might think that you're mad to start a company whilst navigating.
They'd be
that.
Right. They would be. Yeah. They'd be absolutely right.
Well, that first year of motherhood, I think, yeah, so many things change. And I think adding in a new change, like founding a business, must have been incredibly challenging. But you went for it. And essentially, you've created an incredibly, incredibly successful, like seven-figure successful business from your kitchen table, is what I hear. So yeah, talk That's to us awesome. About that journey.
Yeah, I think it's really about knowing yourself. So I think I'm someone who likes to move at 100 miles an hour. That is my MO. And actually, if I'm not doing that, it doesn't make me happy. So yeah, we started the business pretty much like 2 months before I gave birth to my son. I was actually at a trade show 2 days before giving birth, pushing trolleys, like fixing up stands, selling product like a proper Del Boy. On the sand, and then went into labor a couple of days later, and it was a tremendously exciting experience, but also obviously really hard. I had 2 weeks of maternity leave, went back to the office after 2 weeks after I had my son, took him. I always say I started this business with a baby on my boob, because I was like breastfeeding in all the meetings and people just had to crack on. So yeah, difficult, but for me it was actually the right thing to do, because I think I might have died of boredom if I'd have had a year's maternity leave or whatever.
Right. So like you said, knowing yourself and knowing that actually that's what you wanted and that worked for you,
yeah.
And that, you know, you were willing to, I guess, kind of, yeah, you know, see how that goes, navigate that journey and do it your own unique way. So firstly, tell us about the business idea, because, you know, lots of people, I think lots of people have good ideas. Some people might disagree, but I think it's very different to have good ideas than to execute on those ideas, to have a strategy behind them, to be able to stay focused on what the idea is after a year when new things come up and, you know, your attention goes left and right. So yeah, where did the idea come from, essentially, and how confident were you at the time then that this business was needed?
So the company started, the genesis of the idea came because my husband Joe was a professional rugby player, just retired recently, was playing for Harlequins at the time, was out with Achilles tendonitis, and he was supposed to be fitting our new kitchen with his time off, and he ended up putting a stool leg onto a drill, using it on his calf, and was like, oh my god, this is easing the tension on my leg, feels amazing. I obviously came downstairs and was like, what are you doing? And he was like, no, this thing's incredible. So he took it into the Harlequin changing room. The lads literally laughed him out the room, because they were like, we're in a professional environment here, we've got sports masseuses over there and physios in the room over there, and you're turning up with your B&Q gun. So he sells one to a guy called Carl Sinclair, who's like a pretty successful England rugby player now. And he went back to B&Q, bought 7 more drills, sold them to people. Like health and safety obviously didn't come into it. It wasn't a thought in his mind. He was giving professional athletes. Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of the genesis of the idea. We always say that like Joe came up with the idea, but if it had been left with Joe, it would never have gone anywhere. Like, he would have made a few more B&Q drills and he would have sold them to a few more people. And then I came in, having worked in businesses and helped to build other businesses for sort of 6 or 7 years. And as a sort of definitely not an elite athlete, an amateur athlete, someone who trains every day and loves sport, was also getting injured all the time. And I had no idea what I should have been doing differently. And so we sort of knocked our heads together and said, wouldn't it be amazing to bring the kind of recovery that he has access to people who just train every day? And we didn't really realize it at the time, but I think a lot of business is actually about luck, not to downplay what we've done, but it's about timing and it's about doing things at the right time. And it just so happened that we did it at a time when this category and this sector is exploding. And I think that part was definitely lucky.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask, actually, because I agree. I think timing is critical in business, but also in life, you know, serendipity, those kind of moments, as you said, of kind of luck, like, you know, being in the right place at the right time, being born in the right place, being, you know, having the right, I don't know, opportunities, education, whatever it is. There's a lot of things that have to kind of go your way in life to be an overnight success. And we obviously see a lot of these, you know, whether it's typically, I want to say, you know, wealthy white men telling people how, you know, success comes from X, Y, and Z, but they kind of discount all of those other things, which kind of, like you said, like being born a white man in the right place at the right time and all the rest of it. But timing is, it is critical. Now, you, like, you know, you said, great idea. You kind of think, okay, let's do this. And you, as you know, Lottie, I've worked in the fitness and well-being industry now for a long time, you know, over 10 years. And I've also witnessed that exponential growth and the demand for products and apps and health wearables and apparel and supplements, etc., on and on and on. And more people, this is a good thing, you know, more and more people are trying to live well, trying to take care of their physical and mental health, their emotional health, and understanding actually more about the body, how to train the body, how to recover, all of that. But you must have identified that as well. I don't think it was probably just luck, right? Because you seem to be quite ahead of the curve when it comes to the sports recovery market. Like, that's a whole section now. Sports recovery, I don't even think as a term.
It wasn't even a thing.
Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't a thing. So when you... Yeah. I guess when you, looking back right at the start then, how much, yeah, timing played a part in luck, but what was the initial response? And did you feel like people straight away, did they get it? Or did you have to kind of educate people that this market, this recovery market would exist?
A couple of things there. I think firstly, on your point about luck, I'm fascinated by this topic and this conversation. And it's one that I've been having with a lot of my other actually Black founder friends. And we've been talking about how much does luck play a part in your life overall, exactly as you touched on, and particularly business. I think it's hard for people to admit that so much of luck plays a part in where you get to, because you want it to be all about the hard work that you did. You want to take, you know, you want to take ownership for the things that you've achieved and for them to be down to you. But the reality is, you know, if you weren't born to the parents, if you weren't born in the right country, etc. And I think it's very much the same as business. Like, there's been so many companies that have been started ahead of time. And actually, if they'd have been started 10 years later, they would have absolutely thrived. For us, I think we were aware of the craze. The real benefit that we had was that Joe was in this elite environment, and they tend to adopt trends and research ahead of the everyday person. Of course they do. They're at the upper echelons of what they're doing. And then combined with me just genuinely having a pain point, which is of course how a lot of businesses start, I think the two things came together really well. And I think that's been really important for us, because we're still, Joe now coaches England rugby, so we're still really plugged into that world. And I still train every day. I'm around kind of everyday athletes all the time, even more so now we're building the business. So I think it's the combination of both of those things. And then in terms of like the category exploding, I think we foresaw it to an extent, but not at all in the way that it has. And it's been driven by a lot of things. I think from the product side, we're very much driven by the data. So the fact that people actually have recovery data every single day on their wrist is mind-blowing. Yeah. If you think about that, like 5 or 6 years ago. And now people have so much data and so much better understanding of their bodies. They're really keen to do the things that optimize them. And one of the things that's been interesting for us is actually moving a little bit away from sports recovery and moving it a little bit more into human optimization. As we had this very strong messaging around athletes, and what we noticed was, like, a lot of people don't identify as athletes, right? They identify as people who are just trying to do their best to get the most out of their bodies every single day so they can go and achieve whatever it is that they want to. And so we're kind of moving gently away from that positioning and also realizing like how large the opportunity is because of that.
Yeah. And there's a couple of things there, because I think one, you know, I talk about this a lot in some of the advisory work that I do and some of the kind of consultancy work, but one keynote that I deliver, I talk about wearable technology and this kind of, I guess, evolution and transformation. And interestingly then, when you talked about recovery data on people's wrists, so 10 years ago, 1 in 10 people were wearing a smartwatch, and that smartwatch might tell you your heart rate, it might tell you your steps every day, it might tell you a few other metrics. 1 in 10. Today, that number is 1 in 3. So 1 in 3 wow. people are wearing a smart device, which is telling you way more data. It might be tracking your heart rate variability. It might track your sleep. It might track your temperature for your cycle. It's all these things, all this data, this information overload, which not necessarily overload, but like democratizing information so that the average consumer, as you said, everyday athlete or the person who like goes to the gym, maybe does a bit of a cold shower, maybe they're interested in, you know, nutrition, the everyday consumer who now is interested in health and wearables and tech, they have so much information about their own bodies and they want to use that information. So I think, you know, this idea, as you said, is optimizing, not, you know, the kind of, I guess, the 1%, and like you said, the upper echelon, the elite, but the optimizing and saying, okay, what works for me? How can I feel better to go and deliver my day at work, or to keep up with my kids, or to train for my 10K. Yeah. You know, people want to optimize now. I think it's you're completely right. People want the tools and they're willing to invest the time, the knowledge and the money to take care of themselves.
I think that is absolutely right. And it's not shocking, although the stats are shocking about wearables, they're also not, because you just literally go anywhere and you're watching everybody. And I think it's also interesting you touching on the information overload point, because I think whilst they have democratized data, it can be a little bit dominating, and you can find yourself getting very addicted to that. So I think it is a little bit of a double-edged sword. In terms of what we're doing, I think it's so exciting, because actually our core customer is like 35 to 55 year old, who is, you know, has normally like a pretty good job, or they're quite interested in their careers. They've got a family, they've got children. They're doing everything exactly as you said, where they are trying to essentially live their best life, basically. And the other kind of point around it is longevity. I think people are really interested in how they can manage their physical health so that they live the best life for as long as possible. And, you know, we're all aware that we're living for much longer now. And I think there's this kind of big narrative around not wanting to spend the last 10, 20 years of your life not being in good health and not feeling good, not being able to play with your grandkids or whatever it is that motivates you. So yeah, I just think the space is so exciting, and I think there's so much that we can do with it, and all of the other companies in the space, the wearables, etc. I feel like we're just like literally scratching the surface of what we can do.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, which is why as well, I feel lucky, because obviously doing this podcast, you know, it's a part of my week and a part of my life and a part of my job, which I love. But I feel like a lot of the other stuff, which I guess is kind of, you know, the day-to-day behind the scenes stuff, would probably be quite boring to most people. Like, you know, when I'm sitting, putting together slides and presentations and looking at data about this kind of stuff. But I love it. I'm a bit of a data geek. And so, yeah, I love being able to kind of go in and consult, or like I said, advise, because you just get to go in, look at someone's business, look at all the things, like you said, discuss the opportunities, discuss the potential, kind of, and then leave.
Such a fun thing.
Yeah, it's such a fun thing. And also to be like outside looking in, you know, someone who I know who is kind of like not a mentor to me, but just a professional that I really look to a lot. And he talks about this kind of outside looking in. And he said, sometimes when you're in your own day-to-day business, you know, you know the product, you know the customer, it can be a little bit hard to, I guess, get the outside objective perspective. And I think, I feel really lucky, actually. I think doing advisory and consultancy, you really get to, and you're not biased, you know, you're not biased.
You can kind of just go in and say, in the same way that people in the business are, yeah,
for sure.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, so many questions. I'm going to try and keep us on track because we could definitely talk all night. So I guess, where am I going next? So let's fast forward a bit. So your business has, you know, done incredibly well, as we said, and we haven't even mentioned the fact that you, your business also had to survive a global pandemic and, you know, cost of living crisis, homeschooling, like, wow, you know, no big deal. So why recently, I mentioned at the start about Dragon's Den, why did you decide to go on Dragon's Den? How does it kind of work? Does someone call you up and say, hey, you should apply for this? Can you talk us through that process and also that decision?
Right, so it was the weirdest thing in that at the start of last year, I did my vision board for the year, and big into manifestation and writing it down and thinking about what you really want to achieve in your wildest dreams. And two of the things that I wrote down on the board were getting investment from Google and going on Dragon's Den. And I actually didn't then apply for Dragon's Den. I got super busy with the business and I, you know, other things overtook it. And I got a phone call actually when I was at the airport going on holiday. And the guy was like, I'm a producer from Dragon's Den. We'd really like to have you on the show. The phone nearly dropped out of my hand because I was like, this is manifestation. Like, I didn't even apply for it. I wrote it on the board. And of all the years, it's the first time I've ever written it down. And it happened. And it was, yeah, it was incredibly satisfying. And now we have a lot of vision boards all over the place.
Powerful.
Yeah, so you got in touch with us and said, I think you guys would be a great fit. We'd like to have you on the series. And then you go through a series of due diligence. Obviously, they have to make sure that your numbers stack up, that everything you say is true, etc. So that's kind of was like a 3 or 4 week process for us. And actually, even though I'd wished for it, the sort of Sunday before we went on, Joe and I, my co-founder / husband, were like, maybe we shouldn't do this because, you know, the business is going well. You start watching clips of the show to prepare yourself and you realize that it can go horribly wrong. Like, you could get totally humiliated. And we were like, let's just not open ourselves up to that. And sort of went back to the point of like, ultimately risk is what got us to this point in the first place. So it's not the time to back down now. We went up to Manchester the day before we were going to film, locked ourselves in the hotel room, just watched Dragon's Den episodes over and over and over, wrote down all the questions that they asked and had literally, I rehearsed an answer for every single question. And what you notice is that the same people ask the same sort of questions. And I really believe in, like, you just can't be overprepared for things like that. I think that was a big key as to why it came across so well, because like I literally had an answer for every single one. So we went there on the day. They lock you in a sort of green room and we stayed there for 7 hours. And they do that deliberately to build up the tension. So by the time you get in there, you're like flustered, tired, sweating. Yeah, exactly. And we went in the den and we were in there for over 3 hours being grilled. Obviously, what you see is like 15 minutes at best.
Oh my gosh, I'm really shocked. I mean, I haven't seen the show for a long time, but three hours, like you said, how much they show on TV, like 15 minutes?
And I mean, that is insane. So you stand on a cross, you can't move, you can't drink water, really, like anything. You can't go to the toilet.
Oh my gosh, this is
torture.
Intense.
it's unlike it. I mean, we've got other investors on it. It's completely unrealistic in terms of an actual investment pitch. You don't have any access to any of your data, etc. To remember everything on the spot. And I mean, for us, I don't know how it is for everyone else, but for us, when I say they grilled us, all they did was criticize our business for 3 hours. So obviously in the show, I cried at the end. Like I got quite emotional and I was exhausted. Yeah, like I'd answered probably 90% of the questions and I was just like, the emotion of it all came out of me.
Like, come on, Joe, chip in, help me out.
Joe always says he got whiplash, like turning towards me every time there was a question. So that was the process. Then obviously we got offers, which was great. And I've spent some time with Gary and Tara, who offered us since. And then we recorded that last May and it's just come out.
So you have to wait.
You can't tell anyone. And not only that, but like, you have no idea what of your 3 hours is going to make it into a 15 minute edit. So you really don't know what's going to come across. And we didn't know until it actually came out on the TV.
Lottie, honestly, as a self-confessed control freak, this whole conversation is giving me anxiety. I feel like that lack of control piece, as you said, of perception and how they're going to edit. And it's TV, right? Yeah. So they want to sensationalize it. Like they could have, I don't know, you just don't know. They could position you as this like husband and wife couple who, I don't know, argued and you just don't know.
It.
Like, you
they did have, show me yeah. picking spinach out of Joey's teeth. So that was a win.
Great, of course.
I'll never live that down.
Yeah. Oh gosh, Well, there's a few things actually I just wrote down on my notebook. I always have a pen and paper when I'm doing podcasts, so I can just, you know. And two things I wrote down there from the wisdom spilling out of you was be ready and be prepared. And the reason I wrote them down as two separate things was because you said, okay, I wrote it on the vision board, but then actually I didn't apply and okay, cool. But then when that person called you, there's the due diligence process, as you described. So they have to really get into the nitty gritty of the business, right? The books, yeah. the numbers, the projections, everything, as you said, has to be yeah. on point. This can't just be like, oh, where's your receipts? No. Oh, where's your tax yeah. return? You know, you've got to be on it. And as much as that stuff can be boring and whatever, I think a lot of the kind of entrepreneurial stuff, you know, when we talk about creative entrepreneurship and, you know, all the, it's romanticized, but people don't always talk about the whole, like I said, the tax, the VAT, the data, maybe the stuff that I enjoy, but the stuff that's so, so important. And if you got that call, if you had not been ready, and what I mean by that is throughout all of your business professional life, if that had been a mess, you wouldn't have got that opportunity. You wouldn't have gotten that show. So first, it's like when people put things on the vision board, what I want them to hear is like, yeah, wow, it does work and it's powerful. Like you put that on there, but also you have got to be ready to receive what is on that board. Because if when it comes knocking, you're not ready, you miss the opportunity. And this is, I guess, going back to the point you made at the start around luck and how much of our lives do we actually, yeah, you want to take credit and take ownership and go, I achieved this, and your hard work is your hard work, but you were ready. So the luck, okay, maybe you were lucky, but actually no, you were prepared, you were ready. And then on top of that, you did extra preparation, because what you're telling us is, okay, I watched every episode and I sat there, and when you went in and then you were fired under those questions, you knew, okay, he's going to ask me this. This is what I'm going to say. If people don't prepare in that way, even for example, like, I don't know, a first job interview. And I know apparently now a lot of job interviews might be like on Zoom, it might be online. It's like, have you actually prepared? Have you rehearsed what you want to say? Have you set up the lighting and what you're going to wear? Like, have you thought about how you're going to come across? Have you really prepared? Or have you researched the company? Do you know, you know, like everything you can about the role? Or are you just turning up and going, I'm going to do my best and hope for the best? You know, I say hope for the best and plan for the worst. Like, do the work. Do the work. You did the work.
And I think that has been a theme throughout my life. Like, I just feel like the people who, you're exactly right. Like they always say, you know, opportunity is when luck meets preparation, right? That is exactly what it is. It's like, you want to get lucky, but you've got to be ready for luck. And I cannot tell you how many people I interview and I'll ask them a question like, what do you think of our website? Super simple question. And so many people don't have an answer, or they're like, I'm just going to open it up now. And I'm cutthroat. So I'll be like, if you haven't looked at our website, I'm going to end the interview now because I'm not interested. If you haven't bothered to prepare, I'm not going to take you on. But I think there's so much to be gained from being the most prepared person in the room. Like, people underestimate it. And it's something you can absolutely do. It takes no magical skill to take the time to prepare yourself. Yeah. And I think it puts you streets ahead in so many situations, even little things like, I, you know, stalked the dragons. So you don't really see this on the thing, but when I was in there, I was like talking to Sarah Davies about, for instance, when you do parkrun, because I know she does parkrun every Saturday, because I found that out. And so she was going, yeah, like I do parkrun. So making it personal to people, every time I go and meet someone, I'll do a bit of research about, like, you know, what they're up to, what do they do, what's their background, just make people feel like you've prepared all the time. I think it's an exceptional piece of work you can do them. It can make you totally stand out.
Absolutely. Okay, so another question, I'm sure you probably get asked for a lot of advice. I'm sure people probably come to you and say, okay, what would your advice be about X, Y, or Z? So instead of asking you a question that you answer probably all the time, I thought I'd ask you, what is the one question that you get asked the most and that you answer the most?
You know what, I get asked a lot about self-belief, actually, especially since Dragon's Den. I get asked that all the time. And what I found a lot with women, especially those who want to start businesses, is that often what's holding them back is not the lack of ideas. They've got incredible ideas. They've got all the experience. Like, they couldn't be more qualified. but they don't believe they can do it, or they don't have the confidence to do it. So I often get asked about my tips for self-belief. Am I supposed to answer it? Is it a question and answer session?
Yes, please, yes, tell us.
I think that I sort of have three core tips. One is to visualize yourself, like in any situation, well, before you go and do anything. So before Dragon's Den, I visualized myself like nailing that. I visualized exactly where I'm going to take this business, and slowly but surely it's starting to get there, even though when I was in the trenches, you know, it really for a long time never felt like it was going to happen. So visualizing any situation, scenario, dream that you want to come true, taking the time to imagine yourself living it. The second one is a really simple one, but I have a hype folder on my phone, and I keep all of this, any wins that I have in my life or nice things that people say that might build my confidence. And when I'm feeling low on self-belief, I should go in there, I should hype myself up and remember all the things that I've done and achieved or nice things people have said about me. And it helps to just remind you what you're capable of. And then the third one is really doing the work. And I know that sounds really boring, but I think confidence comes from doing the work. Like the more I've done with this business, the more I believe I can do. And I think that step can't be missed.
I completely agree. I think number three, Lottie, you and I, perhaps we were separated at birth. Because number three, that's the one that sometimes people don't want to hear. But I agree. I think actually when you do the work, it's not about your confidence. So therefore you do the work or you step into the job. It's the other way around. I think the more you do the work, the more you prove to yourself you're capable, you're competent, and you're prepared. Like it's the same thing around that preparation piece. So say, for example, with an exam, we all probably know that exam that you're not really that prepared for. You're kind of thinking, I'm going to wing it. And you know, it's tough, right? But if you've done the revision and you've, you know, done it and done it and done it, then when you go in, it's not that the questions are any easier. It's that you know the answers. Exactly. You know, that's the difference.
That's it. And you're right. I think that's often the thing people don't want to hear, maybe. You think it's kind of like a magic trick to build your self-belief or people are born with it. But I don't think that's the case at all.
No. And if anything, if it helps as well, as much as I think I've had times in my life when I've been incredibly confident, probably, I wouldn't say overly confident, actually, because let's be honest, I'm still a black woman and I live in the real world.
Exactly.
So that's not going to happen. But I think there's been times maybe when I was younger, I actually think I was more confident in some ways because maybe it was a bit of naivety. Yeah. Maybe I was a bit more green and a bit more like, oh, why not me? Sure.
Exactly.
I'll start a podcast. Sure. I'll write a book.
Why
sure.
not?
Whereas I think, yeah, and I think as I've got older, I'm trying to hang on to that because now I think I've had more opportunities. The stakes maybe feel higher. Maybe it's more pressure I put on myself. I don't know what it is, but something that kind of creeping, you know, doubt or the voice of, oh, you can't do that. Or who do you think you are to do that? Or you're not, you know, qualified for that. Or people are going to, you know, what will people think? That voice seems to be getting louder.
Yeah.
As I'm getting older. And it's funny because I'm really noticing and going, no, like, let's remember. Because yeah, I didn't used to, I don't know what that is. But like I said, 10 years ago, I think I was much bolder and I'd just go, oh, why not? You know, if I jump, if I fail, I'll just get up and do it again. Whereas now I think there's just that voice, like I said, just seems to be getting louder. So if, I guess for anyone listening, if they're feeling like actually, yeah, like I used to be more confident when I was younger, actually, even if you get more quote unquote whatever it is success and however you define that, doesn't necessarily mean that once you've achieved a certain amount you'll be confident forever. If anything, it can it can feel, like I said, as though the stakes are maybe higher and it's just a different kind of challenge.
I think you're absolutely right. It's really interesting you should say that because in the last 2 weeks I've had probably like over 1,000 messages from people saying, you know, it was inspirational, I showed it to my kids, all these really really kind things. And I don't think I've ever felt so nervous about my ability to execute. And actually, I think it's like, you would think that's a moment of success and you would be like, oh, brilliant. Like, you know, I'm winning. But actually what I felt is, God, now now these people are watching and it's like, they can't wait to see my journey better. I've made this journey really epic because now they're all watching. And actually it was kind of better when nobody was really watching and I was in the shadows. And I think you're right. Like, I think the stakes get higher. And also if you've done one thing successfully, as you have with many things, you feel that the next thing has to be successful. Whereas when you've not done anything, you don't really have anything to prove. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I hear what you're saying.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit then about setbacks, because so far, and let me be honest, Lottie, like we love, personally, when I say we, I mean me, but also we love to see the success and the highlights. So when I say that, I don't say it in a way, you know, people go, oh, people only show the highlights, like that's a bad thing. I'm like, please, show me your highlights. Show me the wins. Show me the things. Let me cheer from the sideline, because I know, maybe it's because I know what it takes, you know, especially I love to see you, Lottie, a young woman, a mother, a woman of color. Like, of course I love to see the wins. Just show me the wins. I want to see the trophy. You know, give her her flowers. But I know that it won't just have been up, 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 up. I know there will have been challenges, rejection probably. There will have been no's. There will have been doubt. There will have been failures. There will have been all of these things too. So I guess for us to, I guess have that balanced approach and to be real, can you tell us about one of those moments for you and how you navigated it?
Just to stay really quickly before I share a moment, I have had... I've shared my highlights reel, of which there have been some great moments over the last few years. But the majority of time has been literally like wading through treacle. And actually, I think for most people, when they first start a business, that is exactly how it feels. There's been literally no end of self-doubt. And that's why I can talk about it so much now, because I've lived it so much and I've thought about how I can, you know, how I can banish it so much. So I think you're totally right. Like we're all living very real lives, and starting a company and having a family at the same time was a very difficult thing to do. In terms of one of the specific moments that's been really difficult, probably when about 18 months into the business, we raised our first round of investment, which took me forever. And I got rejected over 100 times by over 100 investors. So like, nearly every day I was getting told the business wasn't going to work, it wasn't good enough, it was a crap idea, blah, blah, blah. And that's really hard to like keep going every single day. We got the investment over the line, and I thought it was a great idea to open a shop in Westfield in Westfield Shepherd's Bush, which was actually an astronomically terrible idea with the amount of money that we had.
Right.
We spent like a ridiculous amount of that investment on getting out a shop, hiring designers. The rent in Westfield, you won't be surprised here, is astronomical. And it's open from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. every single day. And they fine you if you aren't open for all that time. I had no experience running retail, no experience running a shop. So essentially I wasted nigh on six figures. We were in and out of there within 3 months. The whole thing failed. We couldn't have made less money if we tried. And we very nearly lost the business as a result of that decision. And I think there was a point after that where I thought I might just jack this in, because I've clearly made some really bad decisions. We're probably going to run out of money. But I think those moments can often be the making of you. And also, I always say to people in the beginning of anything, not just starting a company, but like, you have to allow some F up time, like, and you have to allow some F up money. And I always say this to people going to raise money. I'm like, make sure you raise enough for your F up money, because you are not going to get all of this right. You're just not. It's not possible. So now I'm much more forgiving of myself. Like, I'm doing something I've never done before, so I'm going to make mistakes. At the time, it felt like I wasn't good enough and the business was going to die, and that was my shot, and I ruined it, and I wasted all of those people's money as well. And that was hard.
Yeah, it's pressure. Yeah. It's pressure. And do you feel like as well, frugality, you know, I feel like a lot of founders, you know, first-time founders, startup founders, they raise a lot of money and they need to. But then, as you said, they might be like, right, we've got all this money, how can we spend it? And it's like, right, you know, they might pay people really well, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's like high salaries. They might have this amazing space. They're, you know, there's fridges full of snacks. There's like, you know, oh yeah, expense your taxi ride. Like, honestly, I see this because I talked to, you know, and like I said, advisory work, and I don't want to be that person kind of on the outside looking in. I guess the other thing I should say about that is it's easy to criticize, right? It's easy to go, oh, I would never, when actually it's very different when it's your money.
Yeah.
But I just think frugality, maybe depending on where people have previously come from as well, or how, I don't know, but I think I know, I don't see a lot of frugal founders. I see a lot of founders that are like, I've raised this cash and I need to kind of show to the world, like, look how professional this business is. Look how, I think it's like an optics thing. Like, they want to appear on the outside like we're doing amazingly well, but then behind the scenes the burn can be like, you know, every month they're just losing money, but they've got this incredible studio or space or whatever filled with people that are, you know, yeah, getting paid a lot. So it's kind of like, I guess, frugality, how can we encourage founders to embrace that?
You never met anyone more tight than me now, literally. I'm tight. And that is because What was really actually lucky in hindsight about our journey was we didn't raise that much. It felt like a lot of money, but in the context of fundraising, it was tiny. We raised like 250 grand, which is like a smidgen on the fundraising landscape. And I burned it on Westfield and a few other things because, A, we have this narrative in the UK where the companies that really get the spotlight are the companies that raise huge amounts of money. If you read that kind of press and you're a founder and you're looking at that kind of stuff, you don't see the businesses that bootstrapped and got to, you know, 5 million quid and they're profitable. Those stories don't get told. What gets told is the businesses that raise 50 million quid. And so when you take money on, the narrative you've been fed is you've got to spend it to make it and you've got to do it fast. And it was also the time that we were living in 2020, that was still a relevant narrative. So even though I'm not building a VC-backed business because it's not suitable and it's not what I want to do, I still was living by really like a VC narrative because that's all I see. Like that, you know, there's no one there.
Grow at all costs.
That's all you see. And there's no one really there when you start as a founder telling you, like, by the way, that's totally the wrong thing to do. You're just like guessing. And so what was great was I effed up. That 250 did not last for long. Luckily, we managed to get another round, which was lucky. Not much, about 250, 300. And I was like, I check the bank account every single day and I go through every single line. I'm not even joking. And every 2 weeks, every month I go through and cut out all the subscriptions that aren't making any money. And everybody in our team is on low salaries, but paid by performance. But I learned the lesson and I was lucky enough to learn it early on. I think we are moving into a different world now where profitability is being celebrated and frugality is being celebrated a bit more. And also we've seen the horror stories of what happens when you don't, when you aren't cognizant of that. I just wish we celebrated a bit more, you know, the businesses that get to 5, 10, 15 million and do it profitably. Because there are so many brilliant businesses like that, but they don't get the spotlight.
Oh my gosh, you're 100% right. Because as you said, the headlines or the kind of articles or whatever, they're like, you know, the 1% or they're in a completely different industry. So it's the tech industry or it's an industry where, you know, they've raised X amount and it's kind of, you know, it's like, you know, the multiples are like 30 times and it's apples to oranges.
That's
right?
Exactly,
it's not,
right.
It's like what?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not
You're
comparable.
Totally right. And also no one told me when I started raising, I just assumed that I would raise VC money because that's what all the people do, isn't it? Like, and actually, you know, you realize that in order to raise VC money, you need to be returning 10 times people's investment, which is virtually impossible. And even they know that probably one or two people that they invest in are gonna make it. And so actually the real thing to do is to be so hungry for profitability. Also because the other thing it gives you is freedom. We're there now and we don't have to take anyone's money and it is the most blissful situation of all time. It's brilliant.
Lottie, I'm so happy to hear it. I really, really am. And we could talk, as I said, we could talk all night. We could talk business. We could talk strategy. We could talk all these things. But I would love to know looking ahead, what are you most excited about now? What's still on the vision board? What are you looking at next?
Yeah, the vision board for me is about really building brand and community now. So I always talked about being the Nike of sports recovery. And when I say that, I don't mean in terms of size. I mean in terms of the way they make people feel and the way they get people excited and motivated. And we want to make this kind of human optimization part of your life as exciting as you find your exercising. And that's what really excites us. I think in the very beginning days, you're very driven by having to sell your product because that's what keeps you alive. And now we're a bit bigger. We're really starting to get excited about brands. And we've just won a competition to do our first advert on ITV. So that's going to be out later this year.
Cool.
And just thinking about like, how can we really build an amazing community of people that take care of themselves and connect with each other? And that's what I'm really excited about this year.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to see that journey and also support in any way that I can.
Thank you so much.
So my final question for you, of course, is the Power Hour question. It's for anyone listening who's going, wow, or anyone who saw you on Dragon's Den who probably said, wow, look at this woman, look at this energy, and just thought, you know, how does she do it? I'm sure people ask you, how does she do it? You have an incredible energy. So what does the first hour of your day typically include?
Yeah, so I actually get up at 4:30 a.m. Sorry, everyone. I'm not trying to perpetuate hustle culture, but my power hour starts at 4:30 a.m. I get a green tea. I always go back to my vision board. I look at it every morning just as a reminder of like ultimately what I'm trying to do. And then I sit at my desk and I do the thing that is hardest on my to-do list. That's what I do in the first hour.
Swallow the frog. Have you heard that before?
Swallow the frog. I haven't heard that, but I think it's a really great phrase. That's brilliant.
Yeah, is it? Okay, well, this was 5 years ago, maybe, when I started the show, and I had a guest called Carl Loco, incredible, incredible human. And he's the first person who ever said this to me, swallow the frog. I think there's actually a book, but anyway, and I wrote about it in Power Hour. It's essentially exactly what you said. So the hardest thing, the worst thing, the thing you're dreading, the thing you don't want to do, that. He's like, do that in the first hour, because once you swallow the frog, you can do anything after that.
Yeah, that's totally right. And also it makes your day, it makes you feel like I've done that thing. So I should add in, I do ice bath every morning, not in the first hour, but make sure you get your ice baths in.
No, this is where, you see, I was expecting this to be the start of a beautiful thing, and now...
now we've sorted it out.
No, I'm like, you've got brown skin. Why are you telling me about an ice bath?
Oh my God, I love it. Obviously, I love it, but I mean, the way you feel when you get out, I think, is like having 10 coffees. Which to me is worth
I mean
it.
That's true. I mean cold shower, I feel like if I have to, and I'm already warm because I've done like you know what it is, this is not I'm not the guest, but I honestly think the cold movement, the cold therapy movement and the recovery thing, obviously it's, we know it's science proven, there's no getting away from it. It's good for me, mind and body. I think for me it's just like, it's DNA, it's the Jamaican in me. If I'm in the heat, let's say I'm in a hot country, I'll do an ice shower, but living in this country,
right.
I'm like, I'm already suffering. Okay,
I'm already suffering. Yeah, I hear you.
Yes,
It took me a real while to get into it, but now I'm into it. I'm addicted. It's very addictive, as you can tell by the.
But now you ice bath every morning.
Yeah,
is it outside?
Unless it, so speaking of being a black woman, if it's raining, I ain't going outside. So I can do the ice bath every day, but I'm not getting my hair wet for nobody and nothing. Yeah. I don't care what company outside, I'm trying to build. And it's outside, yeah, exactly. I've been known to go in there with a shower cap on and my hair in the shower cap.
I don't blame you. You always look on point, Lottie, as well. She's so cool. She's so successful. She's so driven. She's so everything. And I'm glad. I'm so happy. And as I say, our paths have crossed a lot in the last few years. And I'm so glad that we were able to combine our schedules and make this episode happen finally.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to chat.
Ditto. And thanks everyone for tuning in. I really hope that you've enjoyed this conversation. If you have, please do let us know, and also share it with anyone in your life who you think would benefit from hearing some entrepreneurial encouragement from Lottie today. And I will be back next week with another episode. See you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.